Reading from The Splendid and the Vile by Eric Larson. Chapter 2, A Night at the Savoy. Mary Churchill, 17 years old, awoke that morning, May 10, to the grim news from Europe. The details were terrifying in themselves, but it was the juxtaposition between how Mary had spent her night and what had happened across the English Channel that made it all the more shocking. Mary was the youngest of Churchill's four children, a fifth child, a daughter named Marigold, the family's beloved Duckadilly, had died of septicemia in August 1921 at 2 years and 9 months of age. Both parents were present at her death, a moment that drew from Clementine, as Churchill later told Mary, a succession of wild shrieks like an animal in mortal pain. Mary's eldest sister, Diana, 30, was married to Duncan Sands, who served as Churchill's special liaison to Air Raid Precautions, ARP, the Civil Defense Division of the Home Office. They had three children. The second sister, Sarah, 25, so stubborn that as a child she was nicknamed Mule, was an actress who, to Churchill's displeasure, had married an Austrian entertainer named Vic Oliver, 16 years her senior, and twice married before he met her. They had no children. The fourth child was Randolph, nearly 29, who a year earlier had married Pamela Digby, now 20 years old, and pregnant with their first child. Mary was pretty, buoyant, and spirited, described by one observer as very effervescent. She approached the world with the unabashed enthusiasm of a spring lamb, a guilelessness that a young American visitor, Kathy Harriman, found cloying. "She's a very intelligent girl," Harriman wrote, "but so naive that it hurts. She says such frank things, then people laugh at her, make fun of her, and being supersensitive, she takes it all to heart." At her birth, Mary's mother, Clementine, had nicknamed her Mary the Mouse. While Hitler had been inflicting death and trauma on untold millions in the Low Countries, Mary had been out with friends having the time of her life. The evening began with a dinner party for her close friend Judy, Judith Venetia Montague, a cousin, also 17, daughter of the late Edwin Samuel Montague, former Secretary of State for India, and his wife, Venetia Stanley. Theirs had been a marriage steeped in drama and speculation. Venetia married Montague after carrying on a 3-year affair with former Prime Minister H.H. Asquith, 35 years her senior. Whether Venetia and Asquith had ever had a physical relationship remained for all but them an unresolved question, although if word volume alone were a measure of romantic intensity, Asquith was a man lost irreclaimably to love. Over the 3 years of their affair, he wrote at least 560 letters to Venetia, composing some during cabinet meetings, a penchant Churchill called England's greatest security risk. Her surprise engagement to Montague crushed Asquith. "No hell could be so bad," he wrote. A number of other young men and women also attended Judy Montague's dinner, all members of London's bright set, the offspring of Britain's gentry, who dined and danced and drank champagne at the city's popular nightclubs. The war did not put an end to their revelry, though it injected a somber note. Many of the men had joined some branch of the military services, the RAF being perhaps the most romantic, or were ensconced in military schools like Sandhurst and Purbright. Some had fought in Norway, and others were now abroad with the British Expeditionary Force. Many of the girls in Mary's group joined the Women's Voluntary Service, which helped resettle evacuees, operated rest centers, and provided emergency food, but also did such varied tasks as spinning dog's hair into yarn for use in making clothing. Other young women were training to be nurses. Some took shadowy posts within the Foreign Office, where, as Mary put it, they pursued activities not to be defined. But fun was fun, and despite the gathering darkness, Mary and her friends danced. Mary, armed with the £5, $20 allowance Churchill gave to her on the first of each month. London's social life was lively, Mary wrote in a memoir. Despite the blackout, theaters were full. There were plenty of nightclubs for late dancing after restaurants closed, and many people still gave dinner parties, often organized around a son on leave. A favorite locale for Mary and her group of friends was the Players' Theater near Covent Garden, where they sat at tables and watched an ensemble of actors, including Peter Ustinov, perform old music hall songs. They stayed until the theater closed at 2 a.m., then walked home through blacked-out streets. She adored the beauty and mystery conjured on nights when the moon was full. Emerging from streets deep in shadow like dark valleys, into the great expanse of Trafalgar Square, flooded with moonlight, the classical symmetry of St. Martin in the Fields etched in the background, and Nelson's column soaring away up into the night above his guardian lions, so formidable and black. It was a sight I shall never forget. Among the men at Judy Montague's dinner was a young army major named Mark Howard, whom Mary judged to be handsome and debonair, and whom she rather fancied. Fated to die in action in 4 years' time, Howard was a major with the Coldstream Guards, the oldest continuously serving regiment in Britain's regular army. Though an active combat unit, its duties included helping guard Buckingham Palace. After dinner, Mary, Mark, and their friends went to the famed Savoy Hotel to dance, then moved on to a nightclub favored by London's well-off young men and women, the 400 Club, known as the Nighttime Headquarters of Society. Situated in a cellar in Leicester Square, the club stayed open until dawn, as guests waltzed and foxtrotted to the music of an 18-piece orchestra. Danced almost exclusively with Mark, Mary wrote in her diary. V nice. Home and bed, 4 a.m. That morning, Friday, May 10, she learned of Hitler's lightning attacks in Europe. In her diary, she wrote, "While Mark and I were dancing gaily and so unheedingly this morning, in the cold gray dawn, Germany swooped on two more innocent countries, Holland and Belgium. The bestiality of the attack is inconceivable." She went to her school, Queen's College on Harley Street, where, as a part-time day girl, she studied French, English literature, and history. "A cloud of uncertainty and doubt hung over us all day," she noted. "What would happen to the government?" She soon got the answer. In the afternoon, as she customarily did on Fridays, she traveled to the Churchill family estate, Chartwell, about 25 miles southeast of London. She had grown up here, raising a menagerie of animals, some of which she sought to sell through an enterprise she named the Happy Zoo. The house was closed for the war, save for Churchill's study, but a cottage on the grounds remained open and was now occupied by Mary's beloved former nanny, Marriott White, Clementine's first cousin, known variously within the family as Muppet or Nana. It was a warm, summery evening. Mary sat on the cottage steps in the blue dusk, the gloaming, she called it, and listened to a radio playing within. Around 9 o'clock, just before the regular BBC news broadcast, Chamberlain came on and made a brief speech in which he stated that he had resigned and that Churchill was now Prime Minister. Mary was thrilled. Many others were not. For at least one member of Mary's set, who was also present that night at the Savoy and the 400 Club, the appointment was troubling in terms of both how it would affect the nation and the war, and how it was likely to affect his own life. Until Saturday morning, May 11, John Jock Colville had served as an assistant private secretary to Neville Chamberlain, but now he found himself assigned to Churchill. Given the demands of the job, he faced the prospect of practically living with the man at No. 10 Downing Street. Mary's view of Jock was ambivalent, almost wary. I suspected him, rightly on both counts, of being a Chamberlainite and a Munich ear. He, in turn, was less than enthralled with her. I thought the Churchill girl rather supercilious. The job of private secretary was a prestigious one. Colville joined four other newly assigned men who together composed Churchill's private office and served almost as his deputies, while a cadre of other secretaries and typists managed his dictation and routine clerical tasks. Colville's heritage seemed to predetermine his posting to No. 10. His father, George Charles Colville, was a barrister, and his mother, Lady Cynthia Crewe Milne, a courtier, woman of the bedchamber to Mary the Queen Mother. She also served as a social worker, ministering to the poor in East London, and now and then brought Colville along so that he could see the other side of English life. At the age of 12, Colville became a page of honor to King George V, a ceremonial post that obliged him to appear at Buckingham Palace 3 times a year, bedecked in knee breeches, lace cuffs, a royal blue cape, and a three-cornered hat with red feathers. Though only 25, Colville looked older, an effect attributable both to the funereal manner in which he was compelled to dress and to his dark eyebrows and impassive face. Together, these conveyed a dour censoriousness, though in fact, as would become apparent in a covertly kept diary of his days at 10 Downing, he was a precise observer of human behavior, who wrote with grace and had a deep appreciation for the ambient beauty in the world at large. He had 2 older brothers, the eldest, David, in the Navy, the other, Philip, an army major serving in France with the British Expeditionary Force, for whom Jock felt great anxiety. Colville had been schooled in all the right places. This was important among Britain's upper echelons, for whom one's school served as a kind of regimental flag. He went to Harrow for the British equivalent of high school and captained its fencing team, then moved on to Trinity College, Cambridge. Harrow, in particular, had an outsized influence on the fates of young men of Britain's uppermost classes, as evident in the roster of old Harrovians, which included 7 prime ministers, among them Churchill, a lackluster student said by a staff member to have exhibited phenomenal slovenliness. The ranks of later Harrovians include actors Benedict Cumberbatch and Cary Elvis of The Princess Bride fame, and an ornithologist named James Bond. Colville learned German and burnished his skills during 2 stays in Germany, first in 1933, shortly after Hitler became Chancellor of Germany, and a second time in 1937, when Hitler was asserting full control. At first, Colville found the enthusiasm of the German populace infectious, but over time he grew uneasy. He witnessed a book burning in Baden-Baden, and later attended one of Hitler's speeches. I had never before, and have never since, seen an exhibition of mass hysteria so universal in its scope, he wrote. That same year, he joined the Foreign Office in its Diplomatic Service Division, which supplied to Downing with its private secretaries. 2 years later, he found himself working for Chamberlain, by then engulfed in conflict over his failed Munich agreement. Churchill, one of Chamberlain's foremost critics, called the agreement a total and unmitigated defeat. Colville liked and respected Chamberlain and feared what might happen now that Churchill was in power. He saw only chaos ahead. Like many others in Whitehall, he considered Churchill to be capricious and meddlesome, inclined toward dynamic action in every direction at once. But the public adored him. Colville, in his diary, blamed Hitler for this surge in popularity, writing, One of Hitler's cleverest moves had been to make Winston public enemy number one, because this fact has helped to make him public hero number one at home and in the USA. To Colville, it seemed as though a miasma of dismay settled over Whitehall as the potential consequences of Churchill's appointment began to register. He may, of course, be the man of drive and energy the country believes him to be, and he may be able to speed up our creaking military and industrial machinery, Colville wrote. But it is a terrible risk. It involves the danger of rash and spectacular exploits, and I cannot help fearing that this country may be maneuvered into the most dangerous position it has ever been in. Colville harbored a quiet wish that Churchill's tenure would be short. There seems to be some inclination to believe that N.C., Neville Chamberlain, will be back before long, he confided in his diary. One thing seemed certain, however. Colville's posting with Churchill would provide ample material for the diary, which he had begun keeping 8 months earlier, just after the war began. Only later did it occur to him that doing so was very likely a grave violation of laws governing national security. As a fellow private secretary put it later, "I am filled with amazement at the risks Jock was running in the matter of security, for which he should have been sacked on the spot if he had been caught." Colville's day-after skepticism was echoed throughout Whitehall. King George VI told his own diary, "I cannot yet think of Winston as PM." The king encountered Lord Halifax on the grounds of Buckingham Palace, through which Halifax had royal permission to walk in his commute from his home in Euston Square to the Foreign Office. "I met Halifax in the garden," the king wrote, "and I told him I was sorry not to have him as PM. Halifax, though newly reappointed as Foreign Secretary, was skeptical of Churchill and the wild energy he seemed likely to bring to 10 Downing. On Saturday, May 11, the day after Churchill's appointment, Halifax wrote to his own son, "I hope Winston won't lead us into anything rash." Halifax, whose nickname for Churchill was Pooh, after the A.A. Milne character Winnie the Pooh, grumbled that Churchill's new cabinet appointees lacked intellectual heft. Halifax likened them all to gangsters, the chief gangster in his view being Churchill. "I have seldom met anybody with stranger gaps of knowledge or whose mind worked in greater jerks," Halifax wrote in his diary that Saturday. "Will it be possible to make it work in orderly fashion? On this much depends." Churchill's appointment enraged the wife of one member of Parliament, who likened him to Hermann Göring, the obese, brutal chief of the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, and the second most powerful man in the Third Reich. "W.C. is really the counterpart of Göring in England," she wrote, "full of the desire for blood, blitzkrieg, and bloated with ego and overfeeding, the same treachery running through his veins, punctuated by heroics and hot air." But a civilian diarist named Nella Last had a different view, one she reported to Mass Observation, an organization launched in Britain 2 years before the war that recruited hundreds of volunteers to keep daily diaries, with the goal of helping sociologists better understand ordinary British life. The diarists were encouraged to hone their observational skills by describing everything on their own fireplace mantles and on the mantles of friends. Many volunteers, like Last, kept their diaries throughout the war. "If I had to spend my whole life with a man," she wrote, "I'd choose Chamberlain. But I think I would sooner have Mr. Churchill if there was a storm and I was shipwrecked." The public and Churchill's allies greeted his appointment with applause. Letters and telegrams of congratulations arrived at Admiralty House in a torrent. Two of these surely tickled Churchill, both from women with whom he had been friends for a long time, and who, at varying points, may have harbored romantic aspirations. Clementine certainly wondered, and was said to be wary of both women. "My wish is realized," wrote Violet Bonham Carter, daughter of H. H. Asquith, the former Prime Minister, who died in 1928. "I can now face all that is to come with faith and confidence." She knew Churchill well, and had no doubt that his energy and pugnacity would transfigure the office. "I know, as you do, that the wind has been sown, and that we must all reap the whirlwind," she wrote. "But you will ride it, instead of being driven before it. Thank heaven that you are there, and at the helm of our destiny, and may the nation's spirit be kindled by your own." The second letter was from Venetia Stanley, the woman who had carried on the epistolary affair with Asquith. "Darling," Venetia wrote now to Churchill, "I want to add my voice to the great paean of joy which has gone up all over the civilized world when you became PM. Thank God at last." She rejoiced, she told him, in the fact that "you have been given the chance of saving us all." She added a postscript. "Incidentally, how nice to have number 10 once more occupied by someone one loves." Chapter 3. London and Washington. America loomed large in Churchill's thinking about the war and its ultimate outcome. Hitler seemed poised to overwhelm Europe. Germany's air force, the Luftwaffe, was believed to be far larger and more powerful than Britain's Royal Air Force, the RAF, and its submarines and surface raiders were by now severely impeding the flow of food, arms, and raw materials that were so vital to the island nation. The prior war had shown how potent the United States could be as a military force when roused to action. Now it alone seemed to have the wherewithal to even the sides. Just how important America was in Churchill's strategic thinking became evident to his son Randolph one morning soon after Churchill's appointment, when Randolph walked into his father's bedroom at Admiralty House and found him standing before a wash basin and mirror, shaving. Randolph was home on leave from the 4th Queen's Own Hussars, Churchill's old regiment, in which Randolph now served as an officer. "Sit down, dear boy, and read the papers while I finish shaving," Churchill told him. After a few moments, Churchill made a half turn toward his son. "I think I see my way through," he said. He turned back to the mirror. Randolph understood that his father was talking about the war. The remark startled him, he recalled, for he himself saw little chance that Britain could win. "Do you mean that we can avoid defeat?" Randolph asked. "Or beat the bastards?" At this, Churchill threw his razor into the basin and whirled to face his son. "Of course I mean we can beat them," he snapped. "Well, I'm all for it," Randolph said, "but I don't see how you can do it." Churchill dried his face. "I shall drag the United States in." In America, the public had no interest in being dragged anywhere, least of all into a war in Europe. This was a change from early in the conflict, when a Gallup poll found that 42% of Americans felt that if in the coming months France and Britain seemed certain to be defeated, the United States should declare war on Germany and send troops. 48% said no. But Hitler's invasion of the Low Countries drastically altered the public's attitude. In a poll taken in May 1940, Gallup found that 93% opposed a declaration of war, a stance known as isolationism. The U.S. Congress had previously codified this antipathy with the passage, starting in 1935, of a series of laws, the Neutrality Acts, that closely regulated the export of weapons and munitions and barred their transport on American ships to any nation at war. Americans were sympathetic toward England, But now came questions as to just how stable the British Empire was, having thrown out its government on the same day that Hitler invaded Holland, Belgium, and Luxembourg. On Saturday morning, May 11, President Roosevelt convened a cabinet meeting at the White House, at which England's new prime minister became a topic of discussion. The central question was whether he could possibly prevail in this newly expanded war. Roosevelt had exchanged communiques with Churchill a number of times in the past, while Churchill was First Lord of the Admiralty, but had kept these secret for fear of inflaming American public opinion. The overall tone of the cabinet meeting was skeptical. Among those present was Harold L. Ickes, Secretary of the Interior, an influential advisor to Roosevelt, who was credited with implementing Roosevelt's program of social works and financial reforms known as the New Deal. Apparently, Ickes said, Churchill is very unreliable under the influence of drink. Ickes further dismissed Churchill as too old. According to Francis Perkins, Secretary of Labor, during this meeting, Roosevelt seemed uncertain about Churchill. Doubts about the new prime minister, in particular his consumption of alcohol, had been sown well before the meeting, however. In February 1940, Sumner Wells, Undersecretary of the U.S. State Department, had set off on an international tour, the Wells Mission, to meet with leaders in Berlin, London, Rome, and Paris to gauge political conditions in Europe. Among those he visited was Churchill, then First Lord of the Admiralty. Wells wrote about the encounter in his subsequent report. When I was shown into his office, Mr. Churchill was sitting in front of the fire, smoking a 24-inch cigar and drinking a whiskey and soda. It was quite obvious that he had consumed a good many whiskies before I arrived. The main source of skepticism about Churchill, however, was America's ambassador to Britain, Joseph Kennedy, who disliked the prime minister and repeatedly filed pessimistic reports about Britain's prospects and Churchill's character. At one point, Kennedy repeated to Roosevelt the gist of a remark made by Chamberlain that Churchill has developed into a fine two-handed drinker and his judgment has never proved good. Kennedy, in turn, was not well-liked in London. The wife of Churchill's foreign secretary, Lord Halifax, detested the ambassador for his pessimism about Britain's chances for survival and his prediction that the RAF would quickly be crushed. She wrote, "I could have killed him with pleasure."